This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Student loan relief for borrowers who need it most is a fact sheet that President Biden has recently made available to people puzzling about the decision by the president, so far not vouchsafed by Congress, however the debate continues, about his intention to propose loan forgiveness for the Department of Education, two pieces, $20,000 for debt relief to Pell Grant recipients, undergraduates with exceptional financial needs, for example, and $10,000 for other students. And there are limits to this program. However, the program itself is something to measure on the basis of its authority. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow. He teaches law at NYU and University of Chicago, writing most recently at Defining Ideas about the constitutionality or lack of to the presidential decision so far. Richard, a very good day to you. Thank you very much. And in your essay, you cite a metaphor that I immediately stopped and thought, who came up with this? It goes like this. You do not hide an elephant in a mouse hole. Whose idea is that? Good evening to you, Richard.
Well, it's an idea of one of the great stylists in the history of the Supreme Court, Nino Scalia. And what he was trying to talk about was whether or not you could find in subordinate clauses of large statutes authorizations to make major tectonic shifts in the way in which you start to think of particular programs. And it turns out that if you look at the way in which things go, if a president, particularly a Democratic president, as it turns out, is blocked in some initiative because he can't get a presidential or congressional approval, what they try to do is to find the mouse hole and then stuff this huge elephant in it and claim that they have a form of deference entitlement, which allows them to do so. And the most famous recent case on that was the one associated with the change in energy mix in the West Virginia case, where you had a provision which essentially allowed you to use the best systems of emissions reduction. And instead of figuring out how it is you put a filter on an air conditioner, what you do is you say, well, the way in which we have this problem solved is we shut down fossil fuel facilities in a certain amount and require people to essentially start creating solar and wind situations and condition the permits on one on the other. And the majority of the court rejected that as being a kind of an extravagant change, which you don't want to be made in that fashion. When they started to talk about some of the vaccine mandates under OSHA, we got exactly the same kind of reaction. You can't put something this big in a statute that's small. And now when you come to the student loan situation, a program which gave the president the power to waive and modify particular terms, okay, we'll give you the money even though you didn't file the form correctly. Okay, we'll give you the money. The form came in 2 days late, is now treated as a carte blanche to allow you to essentially waive, oh, we don't know exactly how much, but the betting estimates are somewhere around $500 billion in outright forgiveness. And then through radical changes in the loan repayment schedule, it may yet come up to another $500 billion. So every dime that people thought they would save with the Inflation Reduction Act has been spent out by an executive order. And Biden is the master of this. He does more executive orders than anybody else. Trump did relatively few, and many of his executive orders were not, I'm going to impose a new program on you. His executive orders, I'm going to get rid of an obstacle that somebody else put in front of me. So, for example, back in 2017, there was the question of whether or not to authorize the DAPA, that is pipeline, which takes gasoline from the Bakken fields in South Dakota and brings them down to Illinois for further transfer. And it had been blocked by a phony order issued by the Obama administration requiring for a pipeline that was virtually done, a whole new environmental study. And what Trump said is, I'm not going to require the environmental study. If Congress now wants to approve this project, it can do so by a vote, which it promptly did. So then when the Biden administration comes in, it's not that they get rid of procedural obstacles. He just shuts down the Keystone Pipeline on the grounds that it's an environmental hazard. And as ever, one of the things that you know is that people who proudly proclaim that they're scientists to the core turn out to be exactly the opposite. And this is clearly a political maneuver in which what you do is you heighten the risk associated with fossil fuels, undermine the understate the risk and overstate the benefits associated with non-renewables, and then announce that what we need to do is to have yourself yet another sea change. And I think that the elephant is no longer going to be able to live in the mouse hole. I think most of the Supreme Court has already decided to change this. And in terms of the ability of administrative agencies and the president by executive order to transform the world, this is a really major structural reform which will impact every substantive area.
Apparently, the president's counselors, because this was a memo from the Office of Legal Counsel at the White House, Mr. Schroeder, the legal counsel advises the president to build a deal of this on the idea of national emergency. However, I believe they're referring to the pandemic. Does that apply for this matter that the national emergency continues indefinitely?
Well, I think the whole question about national emergencies has become one of the great scandals of COVID. If you look at the kinds of things that they talked about emergencies, they were talking about what happened in Iraq with respect to the 9/11 situation and so forth. They're talking about other military engagements and warlike activities. And emergencies are sudden, sharp events like hurricanes, blackouts, and so forth, where you have to scramble to get people out of floods and the like. And so I think, in effect, that the phrase that there is a permanent emergency is kind of like a contradiction in terms and should be banned from the language. And as I noted in my column on the Hoover side, this is kind of a disease. One of the worst offenders is Governor Jay Pritzker, a very weak governor in my view, who declares emergencies every month. Oh, there's the same emergency over and over again. What the emergency does, this is just not labeling, it increases the scope for unilateral executive action in everything you want to do. Orders for masks, orders for various kinds of contracts that you can make, doing them without bid and so forth. So it's a big deal when you do that. And one of the terrible things about the Schroeder memo is it just puts this stuff out there, notes that there was indeed emergency in March when nobody knew what was going on, that is March of 2020, and then just assumes that it continues. But if this is a program that has a precondition, the president cannot deem, quote unquote, the precondition satisfied. He has to establish it. And if anything, what's happening now, thank God, a little bit late in time, is a return to a normalcy. So instead of seeing people tightening restrictions, they're loosening them. Governor Hochschild, not my favorite person as a governor, she has decided to relax the use of masks on mass transit. That's hardly the sign of an emergency. So I regard this as just a cheap rhetorical trick. And I think, in fact, that any court that looks at this situation should not give deference to any administrator who abuses the English language in an effort to expand the power of the government for which he works. So I think the emergency trope is terrible. And if you then look further back into the situation, all the other stuff they do about, you know, can you give a carte blanche waiver of these things, I think you discover that that's equally suspect.
The question of not conferring with Congress, that would be something that would happen in an emergency because you can't gather the body and legislative process and debate and witnesses and hearings. All of that is an apparatus meant to slow the process so that the people can enjoy the fruits of the conversation. That is not emergency. In this instance, the president had time to go to Congress and to make his case. Is there a reason he avoids this other than, you know, the politics, which is, of course, what the president and the White House are? They're politicians.
I think he thought he would lose with respect to this kind of program. I mean, there's kind of a general rule as you get closer and closer to elections, people are more worried about the responses back home and less worried about the ire of the president. And there are many people who have come from working class districts and so forth who do not see this as a relief to them, but it's a relief to people who are more privileged and successful than they are, and they will have to pick up some of the taxes. So there's a lot of real anger out there on the other side.
Well, that is accurate, Richard. That's not a rhetorical point.
I know it's not rhetorical. What happens is Biden, in effect, if he did this, what happens is he now spares all of the people in Congress from having to vote for him in their election. So he just takes this particular route because he knows he can't win. Barack Obama started this situation. I'm always in favor of Congress when I could pass legislation through it, and I'm always against it when I can't. And so what's happened is we talk about threats threats to the democratic process. And the greatest threat is not some erratic riot, terrible situation as it is, that lasts for 3 hours. It's the endemic and institutional practices of sitting president to do more and more through executive order so that the entire system of separation of powers can be completely undermined. And Biden is really, in some, that sense, an institutional wrecker. And this particular memo is a very shoddy piece of work done under command from the top, and it doesn't hold up. The real question some people ask, is there any way to find somebody who could bring this to court? That's a very learned issue over standing, but it would be the ultimate in irony to say, well, nobody can challenge this in court for any reason, no matter how valuable. But at the same time, we believe in a heightened oversight of what the president does on his own. You can't keep the two positions together. You can't get the court, but we really have to give you oversight. So we will see how the standing doctrine plays out in the weeks and months to come ahead, because this thing is going to be surely challenged. And my view is the challenges ought to be allowed and the program ought to be scrubbed. If there are lesser adjustments that he wants to make consistent with past practices, that's an entirely different thing.
Professor Richard Epstein, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, reflecting upon a decision by the president most recently. However, we'll now turn to reflect upon a decision by the president and the Congress within these last weeks, which is called the Inflation Reduction Act, in light of the emergency around the world, but especially among our European allies, for energy. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.